any day he wished. He could take down the journal from the row of journals and relive that night again. Although he never had. It was strange, he thought, how there was never time, or never seemed to be the time, to thumb through and retread in part what he'd recorded through the years. He turned from the message machine and rolled a number 3 liquid tank into place beneath the materializer, positioning it exactly and locking it in place. Then he pulled out the retracting hose and thumbed the selector over to number 27. He filled the tank and let the hose slide back into the wall. Back at the machine, he cleared the plate and sent off his confirmation that all was ready for the traveler from Thuban, got back double confirmation from the other end, then threw the machine to neutral, ready to receive again. He went from the machine to the filing cabinet that stood next to his desk and pulled out a drawer jammed with filing cards. He looked, and Thuban 6 was there, keyed to August 22, 1931. He walked across the room to the wall filled with books and rows of magazines and journals, filled from floor to ceiling, and found the record book he wanted. Carrying it, he walked back to his desk. August 22, 1931, he found, when he located the entry, had been one of his lighter days. There had been one traveler only, the one from Thuban 6, and although the entry for the day filled almost a page in his small, crabbed writing, he had devoted no more than one paragraph to the visitor. "Came today," it read. "A blob from Thuban 6. There is no other way in which one might describe it. It is simply a mass of matter, presumably of flesh, and this mass seems to go through some sort of rhythmic change in shape, for periodically it is globular, then begins to flatten out until it lies in the bottom of the tank, somewhat like a pancake. Then it begins to contract and pull in upon itself until finally it is a ball again. This change is rather slow and definitely rhythmic, but only in the sense that it follows the same pattern. It seems to have no relation to time. I tried timing it and could detect no time pattern. The shortest period needed to complete the cycle was 7 minutes, and the longest was 18. Perhaps over a longer period one might be able to detect a time rhythm, but I didn't have the time. The semantic translator did not work with it, but it did emit for me a series of sharp clicks, as if it might be clicking claws together, although it had no claws that I could see. When I looked this up in the Pasymology Manual, I learned that what it was trying to say was that it was all right, that it needed no attention, and please leave it alone, which I did thereafter. And at the end of the paragraph, jammed into the little space that had been left, was the notation, "See October 16th, 1931. He turned the pages until he came to October 16th, and that had been one of the days, he saw, that Ulysses had arrived to inspect the station. His name, of course, was not Ulysses. As a matter of fact, he had no name at all. Among his people, there was no need of names. There was other identifying terminology which was far more expressive than mere names. But this terminology, even the very concept of it, was such that it could not be grasped, much less put to use, by human beings. "I shall call you Ulysses," Enoch recalled telling him the first time they had met. "I need to call you something."
"It is agreeable,"
said the then strange being, but no longer strange.
"Might one ask why the name Ulysses?"
"Because it is the name of a great man of my race."
"I am glad you chose it," said the newly christened being. "To my hearing it has a dignified and noble sound, and, between the two of us, I shall be glad to bear it. And I shall call you Enoch, for the two of us shall work together for many of your years."
And it had been many years, thought Enoch, with the record book open to that October entry of more than 30 years ago. Years that had been satisfying and enriching in a way that one could not have imagined until it had all been laid out before him. And it would go on, he thought, much longer than it already had gone on, for many centuries more, for 1,000 years, perhaps. And at the end of that 1,000 years, what would he know then? Although perhaps, he thought, the knowing was not the most important part of it. And none of it, he knew, might come to pass, for there was interference now. There were watchers, or at least a watcher,
and before too long, whoever it might be might start closing in. What he'd do, or how he'd meet the threat, he had no idea until that moment came. It was something that had been almost bound to happen. It was something he had been prepared to have happen all these years. There was some reason to wonder, he knew, that it had not happened sooner. He had told Ulysses of the danger of it that first day they'd met. He'd been sitting on the steps that led up to the porch, and thinking of it now, he could remember it as clearly as if it had been only yesterday. Chapter 6. He was sitting on the steps, and it was late afternoon. He was watching the great white thunderheads that were piling up across the river beyond the Iowa hills. The day was hot and sultry, and there was not a breath of moving air. Out in the barnyard, a half a dozen bedraggled chickens scratched listlessly, for the sake, it seemed, of going through the motions rather than from any hope of finding food. The sound of the sparrows' wings, as they flew between the gable of the barn and the hedge of honeysuckle that bordered the field beyond the road, was a harsh, dry sound, as if the feathers of their wings had grown stiff with heat. And here he sat, he thought, staring at the thunderheads when there was work to do, corn to be plowed, and hay to be gotten in, and wheat to reap and shock. For despite whatever might have happened, a man still had a life to live, days to be gotten through the best that one could manage. It was a lesson, he reminded himself, that he should have learned in all its fullness in the last few years. But war, somehow, was different from what had happened here. In war, you knew it, and expected it, and were ready when it happened. But this was not the war. This was the peace to which he had returned. A man had a right to expect that in the world of peace there really would be peace fencing out the violence and the horror. Now he was alone, as he'd never been alone before. Now, if ever, could be a new beginning. Now, perhaps, there had to be a new beginning. But whether it was here, on the homestead acres, or in some other place, it still would be a beginning of bitterness and anguish. He sat on the steps, with his wrists resting on his knees, and watched the thunderheads piling in the west. It might mean rain, and the land could use the rain, or it might be nothing. For above the merging river valleys the air currents were erratic, and there was no way a man could tell where those clouds might flow. He did not see the traveler until he turned in at the gate. He was a tall and gangling one, and his clothes were dusty, and from the appearance of him he had walked a far way. He came up the path, and Enoch sat waiting for him, watching him, but not stirring from the steps.
"Good day, sir," Enoch finally said. "It's a hot day to be walking. Why don't you sit a while?"
"Quite willingly," said the stranger. "But first, I wonder, could I have a drink of water?"
Enoch got up to his feet.
"Come along," he said. "I'll pump a fresh one for you."
He went down across the barnyard until he reached the pump. He unhooked the dipper from where it hung upon a bolt and handed it to the man. He grasped the handle of the pump and worked it up and down.
"Let it run for a while," he said. "It takes a time for it to get real cool."
The water splashed out of the spout, running on the boards that formed the cover of the well. It came in spurts as Enoch worked the handle.
"Do you think," the stranger asked, "that it is about to rain?"
"A man can't tell," said Enoch. "We have to wait and see."
There was something about this traveler that disturbed him. Nothing, actually, that one could put a finger on, but a certain strangeness that was vaguely disquieting. He watched him narrowly as he pumped, and decided that probably this stranger's ears were just a bit too pointed at the top, but put it down to his imagination, for when he looked again, they seemed to be all right.
"I think," said Enoch, "that the water should be cold by now."
The traveler put down the dipper and waited for it to fill. He offered it to Enoch. Enoch shook his head.
"You first. You need it worse than I do."
The stranger drank greedily and with much slobbering.
"Another one?" asked Enoch.
"No, thank you," said the stranger. "But I'll catch another dipperful for you if you wish me to."
Enoch pumped, and when the dipper was full, the stranger handed it to him. The water was cold, and Enoch, realizing for the first time that he had been thirsty, drank it almost to the bottom. He hung the dipper back on its bolt and said to the man, "Now, let's get in that sitting." The stranger grinned. "I could do with some of it," he said. Enoch pulled a red bandana from his pocket and mopped his face. "The air gets close," he said, "just before a rain." And as he mopped his face, quite suddenly he knew what it was that had disturbed him about the traveler. Despite his bedraggled clothes and his dusty shoes, which attested to long walking despite the heat of this time before a rain, the stranger was not sweating. He appeared as fresh and cool as if he had been lying at his ease beneath a tree in springtime. Enoch put the bandana back into his pocket, and they walked back to the steps and sat there, side by side. "You've traveled a far way," said Enoch, gently prying.
"Very far indeed," the stranger told him. "I'm a right smart piece from home."
"And you have a far way yet to go?"
"No," the stranger said. "I believe that I have gotten to the place where I am going."
"You mean?" asked Enoch, and left the question hanging.
"I mean right here," said the stranger, "sitting on these steps. I have been looking for a man, and I think that man is you. I did not know his name nor where to look for him, but yet I knew that one day I would find him."
"But me," Enoch said, astonished. "Why should you look for me?"
"I was looking for a man of many different parts. One of the things about him was that he must have looked up at the stars and wondered what they were."
"Yes," said Enoch. "That is something I have done. On many nights, camping in the field, I have lain in my blankets and looked up at the sky, looking at the stars and wondering what they were and how they'd been put up there and, most important of all, why they had been put up there. I have heard some say that each of them is another sun like the sun that shines on Earth, but I don't know about that. I guess there is no one who knows too much about them."
"There are some," the stranger said, "who know a deal about them."
"You, perhaps," said Enoch, mocking just a little, for the stranger did not look like a man who'd know much of anything.
"Yes, I," the stranger said, "although I do not know as much as many others do."
"I've sometimes wondered," Enoch said, "if the stars are other suns, might there not be other planets and other people, too?"
He remembered sitting around the campfire of a night, jawing with the other fellows to pass away the time, and once he'd mentioned this idea of maybe other people on other planets circling other suns, and the fellows all had jeered him, and for days afterward had made fun of him, so he had never mentioned it again. Not that it mattered much, for he had no real belief in it himself. It had never been more than campfire speculation. And now he'd mentioned it again, and to an utter stranger. He wondered why he had.
"You believe that?" asked the stranger.
Enoch said, "It was just an idle notion."
"Not so idle," said the stranger. "There are other planets, and there are other people. I am one of them."
"But you," cried Enoch, then was stricken into silence. For the stranger's face had split and begun to fall away, and beneath it he caught the glimpse of another face that was not a human face. And even as the false human face sloughed off that other face, a great sheet of lightning went crackling across the sky, and the heavy crash of thunder seemed to shake the land, and from far off he heard the rushing rain as it charged across the hills.
Chapter 7. That was how it started, Enoch thought, almost 100 years ago. The campfire fantasy had turned into fact, and the Earth now was on galactic charts, a way station for many different peoples traveling star to star. Strangers once, but now there were no strangers. There were no such things as strangers. In whatever form, with whatever purpose, all of them were people. He looked back at the entry for October 16, 1931, and ran through it swiftly. There, near the end of it, was the sentence,
Ulysses says the Thubans from Planet Six are perhaps the greatest mathematicians in the galaxy. They have developed, it seems, a numeration system superior to any in existence, especially valuable in the handling of statistics.
He closed the book and sat quietly in the chair, wondering if the statisticians of Mizar 10 knew of the Thubans' work. Perhaps they did, he thought, for certainly some of the math they used was unconventional. He pushed the record book to one side and dug into a desk drawer, bringing out his chart. He spread it flat on the desk before him and puzzled over it. If he could be sure, he thought. If he only knew the Mizar statistics better. For the last 10 years or more, he had labored at the chart, checking and rechecking all the factors against the Mizar system, testing again and again to determine whether the factors he was using were the ones he should be using. He raised a clenched fist and hammered at the desk. If he only could be certain. If he could only talk with someone. But that had been something that he had shrank from doing, for it would be equivalent to showing the very nakedness of the human race. He still was human. Funny, he thought, that he should stay human, that in a century of association with these beings from the many stars he should have, through it all, remained a man of Earth. For in many ways, his ties with Earth were cut. Old Winslow Grant was the only human he ever talked with now. His neighbors shunned him, and there were no others, unless one could count watchers, and those he seldom saw, only glimpses of them, only the places they had been. Only old Winslow Grant, and Mary, and the other people from the shadow who came occasionally to spend lonely hours with him. That was all of Earth he had. Old Winslow, and the shadow people, and the homestead acres that lay outside the house. But not the house itself, for the house was alien now. He shut his eyes and remembered how the house had been in the olden days. There had been a kitchen, in this same area where he was sitting, with the iron cook stove, black and monstrous, in its corner, showing its row of fiery teeth along the slit made by the grate. Pushed against the wall had been the table where the three of them had eaten, and he could remember how the table looked, with the vinegar cruet and the glass that held the spoons and the lazy Susan with the mustard, horseradish, and chili sauce sitting in a group, a sort of centerpiece in the middle of the red checkered cloth that the table wore. There had been a winter night, and he had been, it seemed, no more than 3 or 4. His mother was busy at the stove with supper. He was sitting on the floor in the center of the kitchen, playing with some blocks, and outside he could hear the muffled howling of the wind as it prowled along the eaves. His father had come in from milking at the barn, and a gust of wind and a swirl of snow had come into the room with him. Then he'd shut the door, and the wind and snow were gone, shut outside this house, condemned to the outer darkness and the wilderness of night. His father had set the pail of milk that he had been carrying on the kitchen sink, and Enoch saw that his beard and eyebrows were coated with snow, and there was frost on the whiskers all around his mouth. He held that picture still, the three of them like historic mannequins posed in a cabinet in a museum. His father with the frost upon his whiskers, and the great felt boots that came up to his knees. His mother with her face flushed from working at the stove, and with the lace cap upon her head, and himself upon the floor, playing with the blocks. There was one other thing that he remembered, perhaps more clearly than all the rest of it. There was a great lamp sitting on the table, and on the wall behind it hung a calendar, and the glow of the lamp fell like a spotlight upon the picture on the calendar. There was old Santa Claus, riding in his sleigh along a woodland track, and all the little woodland people had turned out to watch him pass. A great moon hung above the trees, and there was thick snow on the ground. A pair of rabbits sat there, gazing soulfully at Santa, and a deer beside the rabbits, with a raccoon just a little distance off, ringed tail wrapped about his feet, and a squirrel and chickadee side by side upon an overhanging branch. Old Santa had his whip raised high in greeting, and his cheeks were red, and his smile was merry, and the reindeer hitched to his sled were fresh and spirited and proud. Through all the years this mid-19th century Santa had ridden down the snowy aisles of time, with his whip uplifted in happy greeting to the woodland creatures, and the golden lamplight had ridden with him, still bright upon the wall
and the checkered tablecloth.
So, thought Enoch, some things do endure. The memory, and the thought, and the snug warmness of a childhood kitchen on a stormy winter night. But the endurance was of the spirit and the mind, for nothing else endured. There was no kitchen now, nor any sitting room with its old-fashioned sofa and the rocking chair, no back parlor with its stuffy elegance of brocade and silk, no guest bedroom on the first, and no family bedrooms on the second floor. It all was gone, and now one room remained. The second-story floor and all partitions had been stripped away. Now the house was one great room. One side of it was the galactic station, and the other side the living space for the keeper of the station. There was a bed over in one corner, and a stove that worked on no principle known on Earth, and a refrigerator that was of alien make. The walls were lined with cabinets and shelves, stacked with magazines and books and journals. There was just one thing left from the early days, the one thing Enoch had not allowed the alien crew that had set up the station to strip away, the massive old fireplace of brick and native stone that had stood against one wall of the sitting room. It still stood there, the one reminder of the days of old, the one thing left of Earth, with its great, scarred oak mantle that his father had carved out with a broadaxe from a massive log and had smoothed by hand with plane and draw shave. On the fireplace mantle and strewn on shelf and table were articles and artifacts that had no earthly origin and some no earthly names, the steady accumulation through the years of the gifts from friendly travelers. Some of them were functional, and others were to look at only. And there were other things that were entirely useless because they had little application to a member of the human race, or were inoperable on Earth, and many others of the purpose of which he had no idea, accepting them, embarrassed, with many stumbling thanks, from the well-meaning folks who had brought them to him. And on the other side of the room stood the intricate mass of machinery, reaching well up into the open second story, that wafted passengers through the space that stretched from star to star. An inn, he thought, a stopping place, a galactic crossroads. He rolled up the chart and put it back into the desk. The record book he put away in its proper place among all the other record books upon the shelf. He glanced at the galactic clock upon the wall, and it was time to go. He pushed the chair tight against the desk and shrugged into the jacket that hung upon the chair back. He picked the rifle off the supports that held it on the wall, and then he faced the wall itself and said the single word that he had to say. The wall slid back silently, and he stepped through it into the little shed with its sparse furnishings. Behind him, the section of the wall slid back, and there was nothing there to indicate it was anything but a solid wall. Enoch stepped out of the shed, and it was a beautiful late summer day. In a few weeks now, he thought, there'd be the signs of autumn and a strange chill in the air. The first goldenrods were blooming now, and he'd noticed, just the day before, that some of the early asters down in the ancient fence row had started to show color. He went around the corner of the house and headed toward the river, striding down the long, deserted field that was overrun with hazel brush and occasional clumps of trees. This was the Earth, he thought, a planet made for man, but not for man alone. For it was as well a planet for the fox and owl and weasel, for the snake, the katydid, the fish, for all the other teeming life that filled the air and earth and water. And not for these natives alone, but for other beings that called other Earths their home, other planets that far light years distant were basically the same as Earth, for Ulysses and the Hazers and all the rest of them who could live upon this planet, if need be, if they wished, with no discomfort and no artificial aids. Our horizons are so far, he thought, and we see so little of them. Even now, with flaming rockets striving from Canaveral to break the ancient bonds, we dream so little of them. The ache was there, the ache that had been growing, the ache to tell all mankind those things that he had learned. Not so much the specific things, although there were some of them that mankind well could use, but the general things, the unspecific central fact that there was intelligence throughout the universe, that man was not alone, that if he only found the way, he need never be alone again. He went down across the field and through the strip of woods,
and came out on the great outthrust of rock that stood atop the cliff that faced the river. He stood there, as he had stood on thousands of other mornings, and stared out at the river, sweeping in majestic blue and silverness through the wooded bottomland. "Old, ancient water," he said, talking silently to the river. "You have seen it happen, the mile-high faces of the glaciers that came and stayed and left, creeping back toward the pole inch by stubborn inch, carrying the melting water from those very glaciers in a flood that filled this valley with a tide such as now is never known. The mastodon and the saber-tooth and the bear-sized beaver that ranged these olden hills and made the night clamorous with trumpeting and screaming. The silent little bands of men who trotted in the woods or clambered up the cliffs or paddled on your surface. Woods-wise and water-wise, weak in body, strong in purpose, and persistent in a way no other thing ever was persistent. And just a little time ago, that other breed of men who carried dreams within their skulls, and cruelty in their hands, and the awful sureness of an even greater purpose in their hearts. And before that, for this is ancient country beyond what is often found, the other kinds of life, and the many turns of climate, and the changes that came upon the earth itself. And what think you of it?" he asked the river. "For yours is the memory, and the perspective, and the time, and by now you should have the answers, or at least some of the answers. As man might have some of the answers had he lived for several million years, as he might have the answers several million years from this very summer morning if he still should be around." "I could help," thought Enoch. "I could not give the answers, but I could help man in his scramble after them. I could give him faith and hope, and I could give purpose such as he has not had before." But he knew he dare not do it. Far below, a hawk swung in lazy circles above the highway of the river. The air was so clear that Enoch imagined, if he strained his eyes a little, he could see every feather in those outspread wings. There was almost a fairy quality to this place, he thought. The far look and the clear air and the feeling of detachment that touched almost on greatness of the spirit. As if this were a special place, one of those special places that each man must seek out for himself, and count himself as lucky if he ever found it. For there were those who sought and never found it, and worst of all, there were even those who never hunted for it. He stood upon the rock and stared out across the river, watching the lazy hawk and the sweep of water and the green carpeting of trees, and his mind went up and out to those other places until his mind was dizzy with the thought of it. And then he called it home. He turned slowly and went back down the rock and moved off among the trees, following the path he'd beaten through the years. He considered going down the hill away to look in on the patch of pink ladies' slippers, to see how they might be coming, to try to conjure up the beauty that would be his again in June, but decided that there'd be little point to it, for they were well hidden in an isolated place, and nothing could have harmed them. There had been a time, 100 years ago, when they had bloomed on every hill, and he had come trailing home with great armloads of them, which his mother had put in the great brown jug she had, and for a day or two the house had been filled with the heaviness of their rich perfume. But they were hard to come by now. The trampling of the pastured cattle and flower-hunting humans had swept them from the hills. Some other day, he told himself, some day before first frost, he would visit them again and satisfy himself that they'd be there in the spring. He stopped a while to watch a squirrel as it frolicked in an oak. He squatted down to follow a snail which had crossed his path. He stopped beside a massive tree and examined that pattern of the moss that grew upon the trunk, and he traced the wanderings of a silent, flitting songbird as it fluttered tree to tree. He followed the path out of the woods and along the edge of field until he came to the spring that bubbled from the hillside. Sitting beside the spring was a woman, and he recognized her as Lucy Fisher, the deaf-mute daughter of Hank Fisher, who lived down in the river bottoms. He stopped and watched her and thought how full she was of grace and beauty, the natural grace and beauty of a primitive and lonely creature. She was sitting by the spring, and one hand was uplifted, and she held in it, at the tips of long and sensitive fingers, something that glowed with color. Her head was held high,
with a sharp look of alertness, and her body was straight and slender. And it also had that almost startled look of quiet alertness. Enoch moved slowly forward and stopped not more than 3 feet behind her, and now he saw that the thing of color on her fingertips was a butterfly, one of those large gold and red butterflies that come with the end of summer. One wing of the insect stood erect and straight, but the other was bent and crumpled and had lost some of the dust that lent sparkle to the color. She was, he saw, not actually holding the butterfly. It was standing on one fingertip, the one good wing fluttering very slightly every now and then to maintain its balance. But he had been mistaken, he saw, in thinking that the second wing was injured, for now he could see that somehow it had been simply bent and distorted in some way. For now it was straightening slowly, and the dust, if it ever had been gone, was back on it again, and it was standing up with the other wing. He stepped around the girl so that she could see him, and when she saw him there was no start of surprise, and that, he knew, would be quite natural, for she must be accustomed to it, someone coming up behind her and suddenly being there. Her eyes were radiant, and there was, he thought, a holy look upon her face, as if she had experienced some ecstasy of the soul. And he found himself wondering again, as he did each time he saw her, what it must be like for her, living in a world of two-way silence, unable to communicate. Perhaps not entirely unable to communicate, but at least barred from that free flow of communication which was the birthright of the human animal. There had been, he knew, several attempts to establish her in a state school for the deaf, but each had been a failure. Once she'd run away and wandered days before being finally found and returned to her home, and on other occasions she had gone on disobedience strikes, refusing to cooperate in any of the teaching. Watching her as she sat there with the butterfly, Enoch thought he knew the reason. She had a world, he thought, a world of her very own, one to which she was accustomed and knew how to get along in. In that world she was no cripple, as she most surely would have been a cripple if she had been pushed part way into the normal human world. What good to her the hand alphabet or the reading of the lips if they should take from her some strange inner serenity of spirit? She was a creature of the woods and hills, of springtime flower and autumn flight of birds. She knew these things and lived with them and was, in some strange way, a specific part of them. She was one who dwelt apart in an old and lost apartment of the natural world. She occupied a place that man long since had abandoned, if, in fact, he'd ever held it. And there she sat, with the wild red and gold of the butterfly poised upon her finger, with the sense of alertness and expectancy and, perhaps, accomplishment shining on her face. She was alive, thought Enoch, as no other thing he knew had ever been alive. The butterfly spread its wings and floated off her finger and went fluttering, unconcerned, unfrightened, up across the wild grass and the goldenrod of the field. She pivoted to watch it until it disappeared near the top of the hill up which the old field climbed. Then she turned to Enoch. She smiled and made a fluttery motion with her hands, like the fluttering of the red and golden wings. But there was something else in it as well, a sense of happiness and an expression of well-being, as if she might be saying that the world was going fine. If, Enoch thought, I could only teach her the pasmology of my galactic people, then we could talk, the two of us, almost as well as with the flow of words on the human tongue. Given the time, he thought, it might not be too hard, for there was a natural and logical process to the galactic sign language that made it almost instinctive once one had caught the underlying principle. Throughout the Earth as well, in the early days, there had been sign languages, and none so well developed as that one which obtained among the aborigines of North America, so that an Amerindian, no matter what his tongue, could express himself among many other tribes. But even so, the sign language of the Indian was, at best, a crutch that allowed a man to hobble when he couldn't run, whereas that of the galaxy was in itself a language, adaptable to many different means and methods of expression. It had been developed through millennia, with many different peoples making contributions, and through the centuries it had been refined and shaken down and polished until today it was a communications tool that stood on its own merits.
There was need for such a tool, for the galaxy was Babel. Even the galactic science of Pasmology, polished as it might be, could not surmount all the obstacles, could not guarantee, in certain cases, the basic minimum of communication. For not only were there millions of tongues, but those other languages as well which could not operate on the principle of sound, because the races were incapable of sound. And even sound itself failed of efficiency when the race talked in ultrasonics others could not hear. There was telepathy, of course, but for every telepath, there were 1,000 races that had telepathic blocks. There were many who got along on sign languages alone, and others who could communicate only by a written or pictographic system, including some who carried chemical blackboards built into their bodies. And there was that sightless, deaf, and speechless race from the mystery stars of the far side of the galaxy who used what was perhaps the most complicated of all the galactic languages, a code of signals routed along their nervous systems. Enoch had been at the job almost a century, and even so, he thought, with the aid of the universal sign language and the semantic translator, which was little more than a pitiful, although complicated, mechanical contrivance, he still was hard put at times to know what many of them said. Lucy Fisher picked up a cup that was standing by her side, a cup fashioned of a strip of folded birch bark, and dipped it in the spring. She held it out to Enoch, and he stepped close to take it, kneeling down to drink from it. It was not entirely watertight, and water ran from it down across his arm, wetting the cuff of shirt and jacket. He finished drinking and handed back the cup. She took it in one hand and reached out the other to brush across his forehead with the tip of gentle fingers in what she might have thought of as a benediction. He did not speak to her. Long ago he had ceased talking to her, sensing that the movement of his mouth, making sounds she could not hear, might be embarrassing. Instead, he put out a hand and laid his broad palm against her cheek, holding it there for a reassuring moment as a gesture of affection. Then he got to his feet and stood staring down at her, and for a moment their eyes looked into the other's eyes, and then turned away. He crossed the little stream that ran down from the spring and took the trail that led from the forest's edge across the field, heading for the ridge. Halfway up the slope, he turned around and saw that she was watching him. He held up his hand in a gesture of farewell, and her hand gestured in reply. It had been, he recalled, 12 years or more ago that he first had seen her, a little fairy person of 10 years or so, a wild thing running in the woods. They had become friends, he recalled, only after a long time, although he saw her often, for she roamed the hills and valley as if they were a playground for her, which, of course, they were. Through the years he had watched her grow and had often met her on his daily walks, and between the two of them had grown up an understanding of the lonely and the outcast, but understanding based on something more than that, on the fact that each had a world that was their own, and worlds that had given them an insight into something that others seldom saw. Not that either, Enoch thought, ever told the other, or tried to tell the other, of these private worlds, but the fact of these private worlds was there, in the consciousness of each, providing a firm foundation for the building of a friendship. He recalled the day he'd found her at the place where the pink lady's slippers grew, just kneeling there and looking at them, not picking any of them, and how he'd stopped beside her and been pleased she had not moved to pick them, knowing that in the sight of them, the two, he and she, had found a joy and a beauty that was beyond possession. He reached the ridge top and turned down the grass-grown road that led down to the mailbox. And he'd not been mistaken back there, he told himself, no matter how it may have seemed on second look. The butterfly's wing had been torn and crumpled and drab from the lack of dust. It had been a crippled thing, and then it had been whole again and had flown away. Chapter 8. Winslow Grant was on time. Enoch, as he reached the mailbox, sighted the dust raised by his old jalopy as it galloped along the ridge. It had been a dusty year, he thought, as he stood beside the box. There had been little rain, and the crops had suffered, although, to tell the truth, there were few crops on the ridge these days. There had been a time when comfortable small farms had existed, almost cheek by jowl, all along the road,
with the barns all red and the houses white. But now most of the farms had been abandoned, and the houses and the barns were no longer red or white, but gray and weathered wood, with all the paint peeled off and the ridge poles sagging and the people gone. It would not be long before Winslow would arrive, and Enoch settled down to wait. The mailman might be stopping at the Fisher box just around the bend. Although the Fishers, as a rule, got but little mail, mostly just the advertising sheets and other junk that was mailed out indiscriminately to the rural boxholders. Not that it mattered to the Fishers, for sometimes days went by in which they did not pick up their mail. If it were not for Lucy, they perhaps would never get it, for it was mostly Lucy who thought to pick it up. The Fishers were, for a fact, Enoch told himself, a truly shiftless outfit. Their house and all the buildings were ready to fall in upon themselves, and they raised a grubby patch of corn that was drowned out, more often than not, by a flood rise of the river. They mowed some hay off a bottom meadow, and they had a couple of raw-boned horses and a half-dozen scrawny cows and a flock of chickens. They had an old clunk of a car and a still hidden out somewhere in the river bottoms, and they hunted and fished and trapped and were generally no account. Although, when one considered it, they were not bad neighbors. They tended to their business and never bothered anyone except that periodically they went around, the whole tribe of them, distributing pamphlets and tracts all through the neighborhood for some obscure fundamentalist sect that Ma Fisher had become a member of at a tent revival meeting down in Millville several years before. Winslow didn't stop at the Fisher box, but came boiling around the bend in a cloud of dust. He braked the panting machine to a halt and turned off the engine.
"Let her cool a while," he said.
The block crackled as it started giving up its heat.
"You made good time today," said Enoch. "Lots of people didn't have any mail today," said Winslow. "Just went sailing past their boxes."
He dipped into the pouch on the seat beside him and brought out a bundle tied together.